Hi everyone, and welcome back to the Loopcast. Today we're going to continue our coverage on Iraq, and we are going to talk about Sunni politics and the Iraq rebellion today. And I'm very happy to have Kirk Sowell on the line, and he's a political risk analyst and an expert on Iraqi politics. And he also has a firm called Eutikinsis Risk Services and publishes the Inside Iraq Politics, which, you know, we're going to tell our listeners, please visit their site because it has some great analysis, and it's biweekly as well. So, Kirk, once, thank you for coming on the show again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, why don't we've got this political environment in Iraq, and right now the media is talking about ISIS and so forth, but it's much more complicated than just ISIS. I mean, we have a number of insurgent groups in Iraq, not just ISIS. And, you know, the region as a whole has this Sunni divide with both different views. Some of them are, you know, on the conflict, they have different views, so to speak. Some of them are neutral. Some of them have strong opinions on what's going on with the political situation in Iraq. And we have the Shiite element of the country, along with the Kurds, who have a semi-autonomous state in northeastern Iraq. So let's look at this whole situation, very like a brief overview of this, because it's a region rift with a lot of tension as it is, on top of what has been taking place in the last week or so.
Sure. Okay, so if you want me to start with the protest movement as a takeoff and then the election. excuse me. During all of last year, beginning in December of 2012, there was a protest movement, a Sunni protest movement. It was mainly based in Anbar and to a lesser extent in Nineveh, Anbar being the large western province and Nineveh being in the northwestern part of the country. It was based on a variety of different things. Some of it was based on just grassroots frustration and complaints with the government. Some of it was also based on, you know, political organizations. Each of the sites, the protest sites, were controlled by a specific political group. Some of these were groups in the political process. Others were political fronts for insurgent groups, groups that were left over from the insurgency that more or less crashed and burned back in 2007. That went on for the year, and I'm happy to come back and talk about that in detail, but probably the main thing to understand about it is that the Sunni protest movement, even though, you know, most people recognize that at least some of their grievances were legitimate, it was largely doomed from the very beginning for a couple of different reasons. One is that even to the extent they had some legitimate grievances, the way they carried out the protests pretty much doomed them. So they were using, they'd fly bathless flags, for example, or they'd have people get up and give speeches that were inflammatory and sectarian, and in some cases making negative statements about Shia and whatnot. So that was really bad. The other problem was that the leaders of the protest movement were just extremely, extremely inflexible. And so when an opportunity came up to amend the de-bathification law, as opposed to abolishing it, which was their demand, the compromise proposal that came forward, which was in March of 2013, got essentially no support from the protest movement. And then there was a massacre in Hawija, Kirkuk, in April of 2013. And that was kind of a turning point because it caused a lot of the protest movements, which I think, even to the extent that they were flawed in some way, were sincere, many of them at least, were sincere in wanting to bring about change through nonviolent means. Over the course of the year, the protest movement radicalized sort of steadily. And of course, there were always groups left over from the old insurgency that were pushing for a new insurgency. So that, for example, there's a group called the JRTN, Jaish Rijal Tariqa Naqshbandiya. That's the Arabic. In English, this means Army of the Men of the Naqshbandiya Way. This is a Ba'athist organization headed by Izzat Ibrahim Adouri, who was the former deputy of Saddam Hussein. They had a front group that controlled a number of sites. The name of their group was called the Free Intifada Iraq, or Free Iraqi Intifada. So that was one group. There's another group called the Sunni Harak, Popular Sunni Movement. This group is a front for the Islamic Army, which again is one of the relatively moderate insurgent groups that was left over from the 2007 insurgency. So by the end of last year, by December, things were already starting to come to a head. The jihadist group, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham, or ISIS, some people say ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, but I say ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and al-Sham. The jihadist group ISIS, which is an offshoot of al-Qaeda, was getting stronger and, you know, killing more people every month. And then the more relatively less militant insurgents were also pushing harder and harder. And then a key turning point took place in December when Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki decided he was going to shut down the main protest site near Ramadi, the provincial capital of Anbar. What he did was he essentially made a false claim that it was an al-Qaeda headquarters based on the fact that there were a small number of jihadists among a really large number of group of people. He imposed martial law on Anbar's major cities, Fallujah and Ramadi, and this caused an explosion in late December. And so since that time, in Anbar, there's been a full-blown insurgency, whereas previously there were just these episodic terrorist attacks by the jihadist ISIS. Now there's the sort of this nationalist wing of the protest movement, which had become a full-blown insurgency. So that was December of last year, January of this year. And then we had Iraq had an election on April 30th. The election did not go well at all with Sunnis. For the first time ever, Shia Islamists won an outright majority. They won 159 of 325 seats back in 2010. This time, they won 181 of 328. So Shia Islamists, for the first time, had an outright majority. The total number of seats won by Sunni Arabs and also Shia, secular Shia, declined from 101 to 76. And there are a variety of reasons for this, but since our topic is Sunnis and Sunni politics, the main things were, there are two things. One is the insurgency itself. Those who were in the political process had to convince Sunnis to actually vote, as opposed to simply support the insurgency or simply just not vote. And the other problem is that I think there was a certain degree of intentional voter suppression on the part of the Iraqi government to reduce the Sunni voter turnout in Baghdad and in Diyala, which are mixed provinces, thus increasing the number of Shia seats. So the election took place April 30th. Those are the general results. In terms of the breakdown, Speaker Osama al-Jaifi, who is a Sunni Arab from Nineveh, his Mutahidun bloc, this means uniters, but people use the term Mutahidun, won a plurality, but it was kind of a Pyrrhic victory in the sense that previously Mutahidun had 45 seats. This time they have 27. That was a plurality of the Sunni Arab seats, but it was very much a Pyrrhic victory. And then there were other blocks. If you want me to come back and fill in more detail, I can do that. The results were out in late May. So we've had those results for a few weeks. And then what was happening when this most recent wave of insurgent success took place, the takeover of Mosul, or at least most of Mosul, and the collapse of Iraqi armies in the north. What was happening prior to the last week and a half is that parties were waiting for the Electoral Commission and the Supreme Court to finish the appeals process for complaints about the voting process from the national elections. So the election results were out, but at that point, that is to say on June 9th when Mosul fell, The election results were not final. They are now final at this point, as of the current date. And I think that sort of brings us to the present time.
So building on that and this past history with the political situation before this takeover and also on June 9th, I mean, what would you consider the underpinnings of the current crisis in Iraq? I mean, does it have to still stem back to the Sunni protests between 2011 and 2014? Does the war in Syria play a big part in it, or is it a combination of the two?
It's a combination of the two, and I'll take it in that order. There was a possibility to resolve the conflict related to the protests last year. And, I mean, I should note, just to take things a little – I won't go into a lot of detail, but just a little further back. In 2010, 2011, after the 2010 election, there was a lot of hope that the country was moving forward. Violence was definitely down. The election results were more cross-sectarian. The cross-sectarian Iraqiya coalition won a plurality. It was a very narrow plurality. Shia Islamists still combined had the largest number of seats, and that's why they were able to form a government. But nonetheless, you know, there was reason for optimism a few years ago. However, I think that given the way political leaders handled the what I'm going to call the Sunni protest crisis, if you will, and again, this started, I didn't mention this previously, but the protests, the spark for the protest, were threats of arrest against former Prime Minister Rafah El-Issawi, who was from Fallujah, Anbar. There was a possibility that this could be resolved. However, in order for that to happen, two things would have had to have happened that didn't happen. One is that Sunni leaders themselves would have had to have been more pragmatic. There's a widespread belief, an incorrect belief among Sunnis, that they're the demographic majority. And they just framed their demands in very absolutist and dogmatic terms. If they had presented the protest differently and made more moderate demands, I think they would have gotten them achieved, especially since the Ayatollah Ali Sistani and the Shia cleric authorities in Najaf were pushing the government to make some compromises. The other thing that would have had to have happened is there would need to have been some more support for reform. So, for example, when Maliki, in a rare case of a real substantive concession, he put forward this compromise on de-Ba'athification. His Shia rivals opposed it, the Sadrists and the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, which is led by the Hakim family, the Amar Hakim right now. They opposed it. So there was an effort at compromise, but the forces wanting the compromise to fail among both the Shia Islamists and among Sunni Arabs were very strong. And so after April, after the massacre that I mentioned earlier in Hawija in April of 2013, after the election was the provincial elections of that month, in which Maliki lost seats, there was basically no possibility, no real attempt even to peacefully resolve that crisis. So the road to war pretty much started. The road to the second Sunni insurgency pretty much started last April. Now, in regard to Syria, Syria is definitely a factor. It's not a kind of sort of effusive spillover, as some would say, although that's a factor. But really, it's more that ISIS has benefited enormously from having a safe and secure base in Raqqa, in eastern Syria, and in Deir ez-Zor. This has given them, you know, a base from which they can train and organize and fund themselves through their oil smuggling activities. They also had developed a very extensive, very extensive extortion network. That's the term I'm thinking of. Extortion network in Nineveh. They were very strong even before the recent offensive in Nineveh, and making huge sums of money from that. So Syria is a factor. And then another factor also related to Syria is the fact that Shia militias, especially over the last, let's say the last 12 months have really upped their support for the Assad government in Syria. And so you have groups like Assad al-Haq, which is usually translated as the League of the Righteous, or it's AAH. They're a Sadr splinter group, and they've been sending a lot of people to fight. Also, there's a party called the Beta Organization, which is part of the Maliki government, which has been sending people to fight. So the involvement of Shia militias on Assad's side, combined with the empowerment of ISIS and the general sectarian conflict environment, also contributed to this.
And so building on that, what has been the role of Maliki's government in this current crisis? What has been the response?
Well, if you mean the current crisis, just going back the last couple of weeks?
Yes.
The response has been a very, very typical Maliki response, which is blame a conspiracy and make all sorts of extreme statements. After the fall of Mosul, Maliki gave a national speech. This was on June 11th, in which he said the dissolution of the units was due to a conspiracy. And he basically just blamed regional countries, which is what he always does. Never mind the fact that in 8 years as prime minister, Maliki has appointed every military officer of any importance in the Iraqi army. There's no one more responsible for building this army than he is. And then he's also given a few speeches, but none of them have suggested any degree of introspection whatsoever. He's called for the formation of a reserve army. And they won't call it this, but this is basically a replacement of Sunni units with Shia units. And I will go ahead and make a prediction right now and say that probably the most devastating impact of the current crisis is going to be the increasingly Shia nature of the Iraqi security services. Previously, they were never a pure Shia fighting force. The Iraqi army recruits from areas where its divisions are located. Shia, of course, are the majority at the officer level, although they're also the majority of the population. And you could say that at the senior levels, they were, disproportionate majority. Nonetheless, the Iraqi army had a significant number of Sunni Arabs in it. However, those divisions that disintegrated, four army divisions and one federal police division, these were overwhelmingly Sunni divisions. And it looks like they're going to be replaced by newly recruited divisions, which are going to be mostly, if not entirely, made up of Shia recruits from the south. And then you combine this with the increased use of militias. And this is an extremely, extremely bad outcome that's already taking place. The recruiting is already happening. The militias are already muscling up and so on. That's basically been Maliki's response.
And so staying on the topic of al-Maliki, his policies towards the Sunni Muslim minority in Iraq, you've heard in publications and so forth that it's being blamed for the rise of ISIS. I was wondering if you could look at this concept a little bit and its validity.
Sure. I don't agree with that. I think that you can blame Maliki government's policies for the rise of the nationalist insurgency. So if we're talking about some of these the non-jihadist groups, groups like the Islamic Army, even though they're called the Islamic Army, and they are religious, they're not a jihadist group. The JRTN that I mentioned earlier, excuse me. there's a group called the 1920s Brigades, which is backed by an organization called the Muslim Scholars Association. It has its own TV channel called Al-Rafidain. There's a series of these Sunni TV channels that have been pushing insurgency to one degree or another. This nationalist, Iraq-focused insurgency, I think you can blame, to at least some degree, on the Maliki government, or at least its strength. The hardcore members of these organizations would be pushing insurgency regardless. However, the degree of support that these kind of organizations get is definitely impacted by illegal arrests, you know, Sunni young men being arrested and then their families having to pay bribes to get them out of prison, whether they're innocent or guilty. De-Ba'athification, again, which has resulted in the exclusion of many Iraqis, not just Sunni Arabs, but disproportionately Sunni Arabs. De-Ba'athification has resulted in their exclusion, in many cases, from public employment, which in the nature of the Iraqi state being as it is, the Iraqi state dominates the economy, so that's extremely important. Now, returning to ISIS, I don't think that Maliki's policies have all that much to do with the rise of ISIS, frankly, because their ideology is so incredibly extreme. If people are going to turn away from the political process, turn away from Sunni parties that are in the political process, they're not likely to turn to ISIS. They're likely to turn to a group like the JRTN or the Islamic Army or one of these other groups. ISIS doesn't even recognize the legitimacy of Iraq's national borders, which virtually 100%, you know, let's say 90 to 95% of Iraq's Sunnis very strongly believe in. So I don't agree with that thesis.
And so looking at Sunni politicians in Iraq with this current crisis with ISIS, so June 9th and slightly before that, and what have their views been on this? Have they been outspoken against it? Have they been slightly behind the scenes, not talking a lot? I mean, what has been their reaction to this?
The best way to describe how most Sunnis were in the political process, most Sunni political leaders, the way they reacted is by going into a catatonic shock. They have simply, they're absolutely shocked. They have no way of dealing with this. The only Sunni political leaders who have been really visible at all are the Nujafis. I mentioned Parliamentary Speaker Osama al-Nujafi earlier. His brother, Uthil Nujafi, is governor of Nineveh, although you can call him governor in exile now since he was run out of Mosul when Mosul fell. So the Nujafis have been public. I watched a nearly hour-long interview with Osama Nujafi a few days ago, and he put this forward and explained, you know, what he has said privately at some of these political meetings with Shia leaders. And his proposal for resolving the crisis is exactly the same as his agenda prior to the election, which is the formation of an autonomous Sunni region. And then on the military side, what he does is he makes a distinction between ISIS, the jihadist group, and the more nationalist other groups that I mentioned, the more nationalist insurgents groups. And in this interview, he actually referred to them as Ashab al-Haq, which means people who have a legitimate cause. Now, that's a very controversial statement to make. I mean, for the Shia, at least. That's a very controversial, to even call the moderate insurgents people who have, you know, a legitimate cause. That's one of the reasons why many of Maliki's surrogates are accusing him of conspiring against the state, essentially. But his point of view, Mujafi's point of view, and his brother Uthil has also said the same thing, is that these non-jihadist, non-ISIS insurgents need to be co-opted. They need to be defeated, not militarily, but some of their extreme aims need to be defeated by meeting legitimate demands. And the Nujafi formula for that is to have an autonomous Sunni region, similar to what the Kurds have, and including an independent Sunni army. And so Nujafi explained, to replace the divisions that disintegrated, there should be a new army division in Nineveh, made up entirely of people who are from Nineveh, with a chain of command which is entirely of native Ninevites. That is not going to work, for sure. There's no chance whatsoever that Shia leaders will accept that. But that is their proposal, the Mujafi's proposal. Also, there's another element to it. Mujafi and his mutahidun have put forward the proposal that there be a national salvation government formed. This national salvation government would include three men, Shia, Sunni, and a Kurd. And then this sort of triumvirate would govern the country for, you know, let's say 6 months and hold new elections. Now, bearing in mind that the Shia Islamists just won an outright majority for the first time and are fully mobilizing to fight, there is absolutely zero chance whatsoever this proposal will be accepted. However, from the Sunni side, that's the only proposal that's on the table right now.
And looking at the Sunni community, what is their view? What are their views towards ISIS? I mean, yes, there are moderate Sunnis. There are more extreme views in Sunni Islam. So what are some of the things we're hearing out of the community?
An answer to this is going to be a bit unscientific due to the lack of polling. But just, you know, from the collection of anecdotal examples, support for ISIS's core ideology is very small. But hatred of the Iraqi government is so much that I don't think that two people are upset that they're having some success. The problem then becomes when ISIS tries to rule, because again, the percentage of the Sunni Arab population that wants the kind of government that ISIS is pushing for is just, you know, I'd be surprised if it's more than 10%. I couldn't give you a figure, but I doubt it's more than 10%. It may not be more than 5%, frankly. But here's something else to bear in mind, though. When you talk about Sunni leaders, the mainstream discourse, and this is important, it's important to understand the information environment for any population group. I spend a lot of time watching Iraqi Sunni TV, and the people who appear on Iraqi Sunni TV, if you're an ordinary person in Tikrit or wherever, or Ramadi, and wherever, when you go home at the end of the day, you turn on the television, you're watching the evening news, you're watching these programs, TV channels like Al Gharbiya, maybe Al Sharqiya, although they're not as militant against the government as they used to be, At-Taghir, Rafidain, these kinds of TV programs, they'll have people on there, and everyone on there is from the nationalist insurgency wing of the insurgency, if they're part of the insurgency at all. And of course, Mutahidun also has its own TV channel called Baghdad TV, I should mention. But essentially what their line is that this movement is a nationalist movement. It's not a jihadist movement. And they're essentially in denial. I mean, Sunni leaders, not all of them, but some of them, will, you know, get up and say, well, you know, this whole thing about ISIS, this is just a myth, or this is just, you know, a way of distracting from our legitimate demands and whatnot. And frankly, Nujafi, although he was very outspoken about fighting ISIS after his brother was almost killed by them, and after his home province was taken over by them, Nujafi for a while, you know, he never completely ignored them. He always said, you know, they had to be fought. But it was never a major thing for Nujafi. And again, like I said, there's some even now major who will say that ISIS is just sort of a myth, or it's just an Iranian front or something like that.
So I know we're speaking about Sunnis in Iraq, but I just feel like it's appropriate to maybe slightly touch on the views of the Shiite politicians to this current crisis. What have we been hearing from them?
The Shia are more unified, despite being a majority. They're more unified, and they have fully rallied around the flag, if you will. There have been some technical criticisms, of course. The Sadrists will say, well, Maliki has not managed the security service as well. And the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, or ISKI, as I mentioned earlier, they have their criticisms. But overwhelmingly, even with some minor caveats and reservations about this or that, Shia leaders have fallen in line with the mobilization. The militias are ramping up. Ahmad al-Hakim, ISKI leader, gave a speech in military fatigues, wearing his clerical turban, but in military fatigues. That was interesting. And then Muqtada Sadr, who was sort of quasi-retired from politics, called sort of remobilization and what he referred to as peace companies. But basically, this is a way of remobilizing the Mahdi army. And of course, the others who are less abashed about this, the AAH I mentioned earlier, Asaib al-Haq, and the Beta organization, you know, these militias are really mobilizing very heavily. So with very, very minor exceptions, there's a great deal of unity among the Shia political class right now. And that applies to the grassroots as well.
And I know you said it's very minor if there are any disagreements about what's taking place within the Shia community, but I mean, if there have been, what are these cleavages and what might be causing them? What might be that one factor that they might not agree on?
Well, I would say a couple of things. One is that there's a secular minority. And so, you know, there's something called the National Civil Alliance that won 5 seats. So there are secular parties. And then Iyad Alawi's cross-sectarian nationalist coalition also has some Shia in it. So there are some people who are just secular by ideological orientation. But again, they won a very small percentage of the seats in the last election, and that was before the current crisis. At this point, those people are completely irrelevant. Totally, totally, totally irrelevant. The secular Shia are simply not on the stage right now. And then the other criticisms are from Maliki's Shia Islamist rivals, who basically differ from him in the sense that they want to remove him and put, you know, one of their own in power. So, you know, the Sadrists have, you know, they've been on and off fighting with Maliki for years, as has Iski. They just went through an election campaign. But it was, given the war, given the insurgency in Anbar, it was very difficult for them. And the fact is they didn't do all that well. But their criticisms tend to be tactical. It's, you know, Maliki's not competent. He appoints incompetent generals, which is true. That, you know, there's lots of corruption that he hasn't fought, and so on and so forth. But these are tactical criticisms. And then I should note this fatwa by the Ayatollah Ali Sistani. This is really exceptional in modern Iraqi history. Sistani has never issued a fatwa like this. I watched
last Friday, correct?
Yes.
His call to arms. I like to call it his call to arms.
It actually was that. I watched the entire sermon. It was actually a 2-part sermon by one of his representatives in Karbala, Ahmed Mahdi of Karbala'i. And it was absolutely a call to arms. The first part was heavily theological, but it included, you know, a lesson on the importance of, or, you know, physical preparation and conditioning for the return of the Mahdi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a Shia context, when you talk about the return of the Mahdi, this is very, very, you know, it's apocalyptic connotations by nature. And then the second part is when he made the more practical ruling and said that it is the obligation of as many as is required to volunteer for the security services and train to fight the terrorists, the jihadists. And although I don't believe that, you know, Sistani wants at all Sunnis to be targeted, the statement itself did not make a distinction between the jihadist insurgents and the more nationalist, relatively moderate or secular insurgents. And no one among the Shia is making that distinction. You know, watching interviews from leaders or people who put themselves forward as leaders of the nationalist insurgency, they find it outrageous that Shia tend to associate them. But the truth is that they have only themselves to blame. You know, ISIS is very prominent. The fact is that ISIS played the predominant role in the takeover of Mosul. So, you know, they've really, you know, they can give an interview and say, well, we follow the rules of law. We don't approve of the execution of prisoners and whatnot and so on and so forth. But by and large, they also just ignore the fact that ISIS even exists even though ISIS is, you know, blowing up marketplaces, you know, killing dozens of people at a time in Baghdad and so on.
So on the flip side, what has the Sunni religious hierarchy, what has their reaction been? So we've heard about al-Sistani's big fatwa last Friday. What has the Sunni religious community, what have their comments been on what's taking place in the last couple of weeks?
They are more or less 100% united behind the insurgency, with very small exceptions. And there are different groups. They're not as unified also from a religious standpoint. But nonetheless, so for example, probably the most important group is the Iraqi Ulama Council. And then there's also the group of clerics who are tied to this Iraqi Ulama Council, who helped lead the protest movement. The most important of these, I'll just mention one name, because names people give people a little confused sometimes. But Muhammad Taha Hamdoun Samarai of Samarra, Salah ad-Din, he's the main imam at the main protest site in Samarra last year. And then at some point he became the spokesman for the national protest movement. And he's now in exile in Kurdistan. And he and others like him, you know, put themselves forward as the spiritual leaders of the insurgency. And you have other people. There's also something called Jamiat al-Fiqh, the Fiqh Association. But again, they're behind the insurgency, the nationalist wing of the insurgency. There's Abdelmalik al-Sa'idi, who's a older, venerated cleric who lives in Jordan. Again, he was a pillar of the nationalist insurgency back in the 2004-2007 period, and he's backing it again now. And I mean, you've got a very small number of exceptions. You've got, you know, people, you know, Khalid al-Mullah is a Sunni based in the south who's basically on Maliki's payroll. He always supports Maliki, so he came out and endorsed Maliki's plan. And in Basra, the Sunni walk in Basra sided with the government. But again, in Basra, they're afraid that they're going to be cleansed completely. But the national walk, and this is very interesting, has been completely silent. So there's a state institution called the National Walk. That has been completely silent. All of the non-government Sunni groups, all the ones not tied to the government, without exception, are all behind the insurgency. And they're behind the nationalist wing of the insurgency.
And on that point, have we seen them promoting the concept of becoming like other insurgent groups in Iraq? Have we seen an ideology or the call to maybe join forces with ISIS at all, or is that not taking place at this point?
No. I mean, at a tactical level, then all of the insurgents groups, you know, work together when they have to. If they're all in the same city and they're fighting the government, they work together. If they're in the same city and the government is withdrawn, then they might start fighting each other. Mm-hmm. But if we're talking about at the leadership, if your question is about, you know, the level of Sunni clerical leadership, there's absolutely no call to side with ISIS. Mostly they've ignored them, and this is a failure, frankly. Again, given how obvious the threat of ISIS is, it's a failure. I mean, I mentioned Muhammad Taha Hamdoun. He called ISIS, you know, a myth. And you know, they do make statements. They say, look, we don't approve of you know, executing prisoners. We do not accept targeting of any civilians, Sunni, Shia, whatever. I saw an interview with one of the leaders from the Islamic Army, and he made a point. He didn't mention ISIS by name, but he made a point of condemning the executing of Iraqi Shia soldiers. But even there, he didn't mention ISIS by name. So there's absolutely no move by Sunni clerical leaders to work with ISIS. But that's what they need to have any credibility is actually work against ISIS, and that's what they're not doing.
And what is their reason for making statements that ISIS is a myth, that it really doesn't exist. What is the benefit of that to them? I feel like eventually any extreme radical group, whether you're Sunni, Shiite, Kurd, whether you think you're on their side, so to speak, I just think eventually they're going to come to bite you in the butt. I know that's a really raw way of saying it, but extreme violence usually leads to more extreme violence, regardless of who you are.
The most important thing to understand in this regard is the unreality of the worldview put forward by the Sunni clerics and by Sunni leaders in general. And go back to the point I made earlier about the belief that Sunnis are the demographic majority in Iraq. It's a fundamental problem that they've overestimated the extent to which the balance of power is in their favor. In fact, the balance of power in material and human terms is overwhelmingly against them, but they absolutely refuse to believe this. And so they talk about Sunnis being majority, and they significantly inflate their own percentage of the population. And then when you talk about ISIS, I mean, this is a very socially isolated group. Before, you know, the takeover, I mean, let's say if you're from Samarra, I mean, you know, I mentioned Hamdoun because he's an extremely important individual. He's from Samarra, which is a majority Sunni city, Shia minority, which is in southern Salahuddin. If you're from Samarra and you're just walking around talking to people, you're not going to run into anybody from ISIS. You're just not. Now, there's some Salafists, but even Salafists aren't all that strong in Samarra, or for that matter, any other major Sunni Arab city. So, I mean, I can, as best as I try to understand their point of view, I think Hamdoun is looking at it from the fact that, hey, look, I was an imam at a major mosque in a major city, and I've been all over the country, and I've talked to all sorts of people, and I don't run into these people. So who are they? And this also to go back to a previous point I made about the Sunni information environment, the media is much less important for ISIS. I mean, their recruitment methods are not on the media. I mean, of course, they have stuff online, but people like me, analysts like myself, have read a lot more ISIS stuff than the average Sunni Iraqi. I mean, I doubt anything more than 1-2% of Sunni Iraqis, you know, have actually read through this stuff or even aware of a lot of this stuff that's online from ISIS. This is just extremely, the number of people who read this as a percentage of population is absolutely tiny. So the dominant information environment, it's these nationalist insurgents. The problem is that in terms of fighting capability, ISIS and the JRTN, who are the two groups that are generally not on TV, are the ones who are the strongest in the insurgency. And so as a result, people like Hamdoun, they don't have a lot of leverage. They sort of imagine themselves as representing the mainstream. And in a sense, they do. But in terms of if we're talking about the mainstream of the insurgency in terms of fighters as opposed to the mainstream of the average Sunni Arab walking down the street in Samarra, the mainstream in the insurgency is actually ISIS and the JRTN. It's not a group like the Islamic Army that someone like Hamdoun is quite familiar with and very comfortable with. So they have an extremely unreal perception of the world, frankly, completely unrealistic. And then beyond that, it's just based on, you know, the people they deal with and the people that they know. But it's just not realistic. And it's basically self-defeat. I think they downplay it to an extent, but I think that they're sincere in believing a lot of the things they say in terms of the belief that they represent the majority and the mainstream and so on.
Looking at the big picture, how does this crisis affect the Iraqi political system as a whole?
It's pretty much destroying it. The question is, you know, is there going to be, there will remain a political process in Shia Iraq for sure. There's a strong degree of solidarity among the Shia that has been formed by all these decades of oppression. But if we think of the political process as a national cross-sectarian, cross-ethnic process, it's destroying it. Now, I should note that, you know, prior to this, there had been a complete breakdown among between Baghdad and Erbil, between the federal government and the Kurdistan regional government. And, you know, the Baghdad stopped making budget payments to Iraqi Kurdistan, which is why, for example, when people suggest, well, the Kurds can get involved, the Kurds are not going to get involved. There was a total breakdown that broke down. The Kurds have used the crisis to benefit themselves and meet their goals, which is understandable. Again, Baghdad had cut off their budget payments. So the Kurdistan regional government was on the border, basically borderline insolvent when this started, and now they control Kirkuk. As far as the Sunnis are concerned, I mean, other Sunni leaders, you know, like Saleh Mutlaq, has just gone completely moot. Mutlaq has attended some of these meetings, but he's not really done anything. And there's, aside from Mujafi, there's no Sunni leader in the political process who's putting forward any kind of vision. And as I said earlier, I think the likelihood that Shia leaders will accept what Mujafi is proposing is just absolutely zero. I mean, they're so far apart. It's not even where you could talk about some sort of happy middle. They're just completely worlds apart.
So to wrap up the conversation, I'm going to kind of throw out a hypothetical question here. With what's been taking place in the last couple of weeks and potentially where it might be going, who in your mind do you think are going to be the so-called winners or losers of this crisis?
Well, I would say, first of all, the Kurds, because they've taken Kirkuk and they will end up with all of the disputed territories in their hands. So there's some territories in northern Diyala, in northeastern Salahuddin, in other parts of Kirkuk, in Nainua, Sinjar. They will end up controlling these areas. Iran also, I think, although at the same time, it's not a complete win-win for Iran, because it's obviously, they would like Iraq to be Shia dominated but stable, and right now it's Shia dominated but not stable. So the Sunni insurgency is going to lose, but it's going to be very painful to the Shia, and this is an economic drain that Iran really doesn't need. The losers, of course, are the Sunni Arabs. They are going to be cleansed from Baghdad and Diyala. There's been a fair amount of cleansing already. This is part of the basis for the Sunni protest movement's complaints, but this process will accelerate, and those areas that are cut off from Baghdad are going to have their budget payments cut off, so they'll basically suffer complete economic collapse. And the number of people killed from all sects, from all parts of the country, but especially from the Sunni areas of the country, are just going to absolutely devastating. It's just absolutely going to devastate them.
Well, we always like to give our guests a moment to maybe touch on something that we might not have touched on in the talk. Or if there's a last statement you'd like to provide, so I'd like to hand the table over to you.
Well, we've covered quite a bit.
We have.
So let me just say that I think that, well, I don't think that the breakup of Iraq, and I mean Arab Iraq, is likely. Iraqi Kurdistan will be independent at some point. I'm not going to put a date on that, but eventually there will be an independent state of Kurdistan with its capital in Erbil. At some point, the breakup of Arab Iraq is not inevitable, and in fact, I don't think it's likely because of the economic dependence that exists, because the provinces depend so much on Baghdad financially. Nonetheless, that possibility should not be excluded, and it would be an absolute catastrophe, an absolute calamity for everyone involved, including international actors, for that to happen. Because what would happen is that Sunni Iraq would essentially merge with eastern Syria. And negative consequences for every country in the region. And for the Shia of Iraq as well, it would be very bad. What I think is most likely going to happen is they're simply going to wear them down. So there's now going to be a sectarian war that's going to go on for a period of time. I'm not going to make a prediction in terms of how many years, But the Sunni insurgency will lose. The Shia will win. And when it's over, there will be some sort of reconciliation process. And it will be a coercive one, not a consensual one, the way it's looking. But it will be essential for the Sunnis, because from a financial standpoint, Anbar could be just, you know, a much larger version of Gaza, if they just continue fighting indefinitely and the Shia just give up on keeping the country together.
Well, Kirk, I want to thank you for coming on the show and providing this wonderful insight for our listeners. And also thank you so much for staying up quite late since we are talking to you from Jordan. So thank you so much for finding the time for us.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye.